Counsel, on the second case, you all may feel free to come forward. Is counsel ready to proceed? Ready to proceed? Okay. All right. Our clerk will call the next case.
If it pleases the court, good morning. To all three of you, your honors, this morning. My name is David Morris, and I'm here representing the appellants, which are John Anderson and Innovative Mailing Solutions, Inc. This case started with a petition under sworn account against both the company and against Mr. Anderson personally for certain alleged accounts that the company allegedly owed to the plaintiff, Label Source, Inc. At the time that the petition was served and the defendants filed a motion to transfer the case to either Collin County or to Dallas County. Attached to the motion to transfer was the affidavit of Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson stated in his affidavit that his address was in Collin County, that the registered office of the corporation was in Collin County. The corporation also maintained a small office in Dallas County. It was from these offices that Mr. Anderson conducted the business of the company. He all further stated in his affidavit that the offices of the plaintiff were in Irving, Texas, which is also in Dallas County. And if the court will note that the accounts and the invoices to which they're alleging that the accounts are due are also contain a post office address in Irving, Texas. When the motion transfer was filed, a hearing was set. I appeared. Counsel for the appellee did not appear, and subsequent to that hearing, in a discussion with the appellee's counsel, he indicated he had never received notice of the hearing. I could not find anything in my file at that time where I could confirm that he had received notice. So I simply asked at that time, could we agree to transfer the case to Collin County at that time? The response was is that they would agree if we would pay the cost of doing that. And my client declined that offer because he felt like that the plaintiff should pay the cost. A second hearing was conducted on the motion to transfer in September of 2008. At that time, Appellee's counsel appeared, but I did not appear. And at that time, the court denied the motion to transfer.
Let me ask you a question. Label Source's brief says that you have failed to appear, and then a motion was denied. And in the next sentence says, appellant's motion was not decided. Was it in fact decided? Was your motion to transfer venue, in your view, decided at the second scheduled hearing?
I subsequently learned that, you know, that an order denying the motion to transfer was entered by the court. Right. However, I was unaware of that. I was unaware of that until several days before trial, so I was operating on the assumption that the motion to transfer was still in effect. I would also note that in the motion to transfer, the individual defendant, Mr. Anderson, specifically denied that he was individually liable on the accounts that were alleged to be due.
What is the excuse for not filing an answer?
Because we had a motion, an active motion to transfer on file.
But it had been denied. I mean, don't you have responsibility to find out if your motion that you set for a hearing that you didn't appear at was decided?
Well, Your Honor, I was under the belief that I would get a copy of any order coming out of that. I did not receive a copy.
Was an order actually entered as opposed to a docket entry?
I believe there was an actual order that it was entered that is in the file, the court's file.
Okay. So there's no evidence in the record that you received a copy of the order?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
All right. That's fair.
Mr. Morris, was there anything in the record to indicate anybody filed a motion for a default judgment on a failure for an answer to be filed?
There is nothing. There is no written motion for a default judgment, Your Honor. There was a motion made on the trial date, and that motion was granted by the court.
And the motion that you made to file the pleadings prior to trial that were denying the sworn account, those were filed when exactly?
The motion for leave to file an answer was filed the day before the trial setting. As far as from my review of the file, there is no evidence whatsoever in the file that would establish facts which would support venue in Tarrant County, Texas. Rather, the facts support venue in Collin County or Dallas County. So we believe that the court's ruling on the motion to transfer should be reversed and the case transferred to Collin County. With regard to the motion for leave to file the answer, we filed it on the basis of Rule 5 for good cause and also Rule 63, which would be in response to a responsive pleading. Under Rule 63, the court is obligated to grant the leave unless there is evidence presented by the other side that shows that they were surprised by the filing of the motion for leave. In this particular case, there had been discovery, and the plaintiff sent discovery to the defendants or appellants here some 1 year prior to the actual date of the trial. In the responses to those discovery requests, it was explicitly stated in the responses to interrogatories and in the responses to requests for disclosure exactly what the defenses were, that Mr. Anderson was denying liability on the basis that he was not individually liable, and the corporation was denying liability on the basis that there were offsets and credits which were not granted. Between the time that these discovery responses were sent over to the plaintiff and the date of trial, nothing further was done by the plaintiffs to establish exactly what the basis of those defenses were, but they certainly knew about them prior to the trial date, and in fact, I believe there's a statement in the record that states that they were ready to proceed to trial on that particular trial date.
Well, so nevertheless, there's a big difference between showing up on trial day ready to try your case against another party that doesn't have an answer, regardless of what discovery's proven, and then suddenly there is an answer. I mean, sure you'll agree with that.
Well, Your Honor, they certainly were ready to proceed on their case at the time of trial.
It would be difficult if there wasn't an answer. So.
No, it wouldn't be very difficult. But at the time of trial, when there was an oral motion made for entry of judgment based on a default, in response to the motion for leave to file, there was no evidence presented by the plaintiffs that they were surprised. Under Rule 63, in response to my motion, there should have been evidence presented that there was a surprise on the other side, or that there were new defense, or that this was new material that they were not prepared to respond to. There's nothing in the record to show there was any evidence presented, no response, written response to the motion. All the testimony at the day of trial had to do with attorney's fees. So that's the only evidence that was presented to the court with regard to the plaintiff's allegations and complaints at the time of trial.
Okay, you've used the word evidence and testimony. Are you telling us that opposing counsel did not tell the court that this was a surprise, we were prepared to try the case without an answer, and now there's an attempted answer? There's nothing like that in the record.
No, there is argument of counsel.
Oh, okay.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying
there's
that
no,
there was no
witness stand and no documentation.
No documents and no evidence as such. There was argument of counsel.
But how would they have been prepared to put on evidence when it didn't happen until the day of trial?
Well, there
typically Rule 63 is when there's been something tried by consent and you need to amend your pleadings. In fact, I think I'm looking at it, it's titled Amendments and Responsive Pleadings. So it typically applies when you have a pleading on a file and you're amending it.
Well, a responsive pleading, Your Honor, can be an answer, and I believe the Supreme Court addressed that. In Lee versus Key West Towers, which is a Texas Supreme Court case in 1989, where they stated that leave should have been granted for a verified denial of a cross-claim filed 3 days before trial. So, and I believe Justice Mosey, who wrote that decision, basically stated that that in his mind that it was an abuse of discretion to deny a motion for leave to file at that point in time. We feel like that the Lee versus Key West Towers case is on point with regard to this particular case. So, and if you take a look at the entire record in this case, you can see that, in fact, both parties were operating under the assumption that the defenses that were raised in the discovery would be raised at trial.
How so? Both parties were operating under that idea. You couldn't have been operating under it. You hadn't even filed an answer. As I understand, this lawyer's discussion at trial basically was, we're surprised, we're ready to try this case with no answer on file. So how so?
Well, I think that the there was active discussions of settlement the week before trial. Now, that's what I'm telling you today. I don't think there's anything in the record that mentions that, but there were active settlement discussions the week before the actual trial setting. As a matter of fact, the Friday before the trial setting, we had a discussion regarding settlement. So we were operating under the assumption that the case was going to be tried and that we were going to be there. And so I was operating under the assumption that they were going to be ready to try the case and to respond to the defenses that we had raised in our discovery.
Mr. Morris, if you filed a motion for leave the day before trial, did you attach the pleading that you were seeking to file in the motion for leave? In other words, was your answer a part of the motion for leave that was filed one day in advance of trial?
The answers were not attached to the pleading itself, but they were filed simultaneously with the motion for leave.
The response to the sworn account or to the claim of debt due was an answer that was, I mean, a draft of that answer was with attached to the motion for leave to file. I'm looking for, was there notice?
Yeah, I'm trying to respond to that, Your Honor.
On the basis that they had your answer the day before trial because it was a part, at least attached as an exhibit, to the motion for leave to file.
The motion for leave states that the motion, that it was a motion to file their original answers.
And they were attached.
And the answers were filed simultaneously and served on the plaintiff simultaneously with that, although it was not attached to the motion itself.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Yeah. With regard to the test.
Your time's expired. You can have a minute to wrap up your thoughts.
Okay. I'll briefly touch on the testimony on attorney's fees. There was brief testimony on attorney's fees. Itemized statements were not produced. We believe that there were not appropriate.
Have they been asked for?
Yes, we asked for them at the time of.
Not in discovery?
At the time of trial, yeah.
Okay.
And
thank you,
it.
Counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Eric Freeby. I'm the attorney for the Appalese Label Source LTD. I'm an associate of Brown Pruitt. As Mr. Morris stated, this is basically a collection case, a suit on sworn account, where my client provided mailing services to the appellant. The appellant failed to pay those services after a demand letter suit was filed. And Mr. Morris complains, first, that the court erred in denying the motion to transfer. Our argument is that the appellants waived their right to challenge transfer in this case.
Because
they failed to exercise due diligence in pursuing a ruling on the motion to transfer.
Well, as I understand, I'm again reading from your brief, the hearing on said motion was scheduled at the request of appellants on September 29, 2008, but appellants failed to appear, and their motion was denied. Then you say appellant's motion to transfer venue was not decided.
I read that yesterday in preparing, and
okay,
I agree with you that those sentences don't mesh with each other.
If the trial court denied it and entered an order, then how have they waived it? Because they did schedule a hearing, albeit late, and there was a ruling on it.
Yes. In our motion in response, we were arguing at that point that they hadn't diligently pursued it. The case law says, the Austin Court of Appeals, that if you file a motion to transfer and you wait a year to request a hearing on that, that you haven't diligently pursued it and that it's been waived. In this case.
And that's the Whitworth case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So basically, you're not contesting where proper venue was. You're hanging your hat on this issue of reasonable diligence in having this hearing.
That is correct. In this case, we waited, on August 20th of 07, the motion to transfer venue was filed. And then we had a hearing on October 15th, which we weren't given notice of. And at that point, the court said, noted in the docket sheet, if you provide me an order, then I will sign it. Well, appellant appellants, I guess knowing that we can't have our motion to transfer venue hearing unless we have notice to the other side, filed another motion to either enter the order or have a hearing on the motion to transfer venue. But there was a 10-month lapse in between that first hearing we weren't giving notice of and the subsequent filing of this motion, 10 months before any appellants did anything on the file. And then on August 7th of 08, we finally have our hearing nearly 13 months after the initial motion to transfer venue was filed. And that is our contention, is that they didn't exercise due diligence in pursuing the motion to transfer venue.
Is the due diligence in the venue rule, or is that a creation of practicality in case law?
I believe, Your Honor, that is in case law.
I know that it has to be, as I recall, the motion transfer venue is supposed to be held immediately or as soon as possible or something.
I believe the case law says that it is to be held reasonably within a reasonable time and within a reasonable time before trial, and that any ruling that's obtained on the motion to transfer venue must be clear. And in this case, defendants didn't even know at the time of trial if there had been any ruling at all.
Okay, well, just I'll give a heads up to opposing counsel that I'm going to ask him, how does he address this reasonable time argument in his rebuttal?
Okay. On the appellant's second issue, they complained that the court should have allowed them leave to file their late answers. As far as when the answers were filed, the motion for leave was filed, I think that's of some significance here. It was filed at 3:21, the day before trial, when we had trial at 10 a.m. the next morning. And when this was filed, I was actually never received a copy, or was never served, and it says it in the record, never served with a copy of this motion until after the trial had actually started. Now, I will concede, and this is in the record too, that I received an email copy. I think it says email in the record, but I received an email copy of it as I was walking out of the office to come to trial. And the rule says that the court should not allow the late filing of answers if it surprises me, if it's prejudicial, or if there are new claims or defenses that are prejudicial on their face. And I would argue that receiving a motion to file original answers the day of trial was extremely surprising to me.
Well, how do you address his argument about y'all have been having settlement discussions and you knew from discovery what his defenses were, albeit unpled?
Yes, sir. The defenses that were in the discovery pled was that he was not individually liable and that credits weren't given. And then in the answers, which I'd point out are 9 pages long versus the discovery, which we're talking about 4 sentences, he alleges a general denial. He denies each and every item of our sworn account. So not just the items that he alleges credits weren't there for, he denies everything, which we weren't prepared the day of trial for him to deny everything.
What were you prepared to do on the day of trial?
I was prepared to take a judgment on my pleadings on the sworn account.
I mean, did you have a witness with you, or were you besides yourself to prove up attorney's fees, or what?
Yes, I had a representative from the corporation there in the event that the...
And what could the corporation representative not have testified to that you needed them to address his now complete answer?
Well, I had not prepared my...
I understand. We haven't woodshedded. I understand. So
the witness would have been there for Mr. Anderson to call or to cross-examine in the event that the court wanted me to call the witness from
the
corporation.
All right. Basically, you hadn't prepared the witness, whether there was a witness or not. You hadn't prepared the witness to address all the issues that were needed for you to prove up your case in the face of an answer vis-a-vis just prove up your case.
Right. And I would have liked the opportunity to have conducted some additional discovery on the fact that now they're denying all of this, that they were denying the benefit of all the services.
And obviously, I guess you weren't prepared to cross-examine anybody.
Correct. Okay. And so for those reasons, I would say that they did provide me with some new claims and defenses which were prejudicial to my client on the day of trial. And as I stated As I stated earlier, it also operated as a surprise because I wasn't even officially served or had time to sit down and read this motion until after the trial had started. And is another point, in requests for disclosures that I sent opposing counsel, in response to those disclosures, he didn't contest any, he didn't contest my calculation of the economic damages, which I think the comments to the rule are pretty clear that that's in response to requests for disclosures. If you're going to contest economic damages, that's the spot to do it. And then the day of trial, all of a sudden, I have, you know, he's contesting the economic damages. And finally, one last point on this issue is that I think the court was following guiding principles in denying the motion for leave. In Requipco, Inc. v. AM Texas Tank, it is a 14th Court of Appeals decision, said once a party announces ready for trial, then they are not allowed leave to amend answers, to amend an answer denying a sworn account or to file a verified denial. In this case, we had stipulated to exhibits, the court had admitted exhibits, and then after that, the appellants raised the issue of this motion for leave. So clearly, we had already started trial, and now they were asking for leave to file a verified denial, which I think the case law says once trial started, that's it.
Now, did I miss that in your briefing?
Yeah, that's, I came up with that all on my own in preparing.
Oh, okay. All right.
Next, appellants argue that the court should have extended the time under Rule 5 to allow them leave to file their late answers because they had good cause. Well, their good cause here was not knowing that a transfer order had been entered. And in the record, I presented the court with the correspondence where I sent the transfer order to defendants and discussed with the court about, I can't remember if it's on the docket sheet or not, but where the court had mailed the order to the defendants. And unfortunately, my correspondence didn't make it into the file, but the court does acknowledge that it received my correspondence in the record. And I would argue that his lack of diligence to pursue or find out if the transfer order had been entered doesn't allow him good cause in this situation now to file his late answers. I just don't see how those two fit together. If he did, or if something wasn't pursued, then I should have pursued. Well, now I need to benefit from it.
Great. To back up just a second, because you caught me off guard here, the verified denial was attempted to be entered after trial had begun, and that's separate and apart from the original answer. Is that what you
No, mean? Your Honor.
Or was the original answer a verified? You lost me
I'm
there.
Sorry.
I thought he tried before trial at the last minute to file an original answer. Then you said after trial started, he tried to file a verified denial.
He didn't.
Necessary in his
He filed his motion. He filed his motion, but he didn't to file the verified denial before trial. But we get to trial, trial starts, and he doesn't raise his motion with the court or ask for a hearing on his motion until after trial starts.
It's one thing. It's not two. Okay. That's what I was trying to find out. There's
yes,
not
sir.
An original answer or verified denial. There's just one thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And lastly, I believe the last issue is attorney's fees that appellant complains of. First, appellants argued that, and I was the one that gave the testimony, is that I testified generally as to attorney's fees. Well, I'm just going to tell the court that that wasn't the case. The majority of the record, as Mr. Anderson stated, was me testifying to attorney's fees. I believe of the 10 pages of record, I'm probably half of it. That attorney's fees testimony was prepared in accordance with the Anderson factors. I went down and testified to each factor that the Supreme Court set out in Arthur Anderson. And next, he asked me for the billing records while I was testifying. Well, no discovery had been conducted by appellants in this case, not even requests for disclosures. So I hadn't provided them anything. And at the day of trial, I did have billing records with me, but those were unredacted billing records that were just in my file as a matter of course, which had privileged information in it. I hadn't reviewed any of the privileged information preparation for my testimony. It was just the hours, the amount, and then I looked through the file to see what was done when I testified to that. Next, they complain that we shouldn't get our fees for our paralegals or legal assistants. Well, I believe the case law says that we are entitled to those fees if we testify to their qualifications, which I did testify to, that they were certified paralegals. They complained that I didn't bring copies of the certifications, but I didn't have them since I was just being asked for them. Next, they complain that I didn't, it's back to the paralegals. I have to say that they're qualified. I have to testify to the tasks performed, which I testified to all of the tasks performed by the paralegals and myself, and then to their hourly rate. All three of those things which I testified to, which would entitle us to recover our fees for the paralegal's time. And finally, he complains that the attorney's fees in this case are higher than more than the amount, the principal amount sought, which I believe the principal amount sought was roughly $4,250, and we had $4,800 in fees. I've been practicing law for almost 5 years now, but I've yet to see a case that I can take to trial for less than $5,000. And the amount of the fees incurred in the Anderson case, the Supreme Court says that that's just one factor to consider in considering the amount of attorney's fees to award. So I would say that $4,800 to take a case to trial, appear for several motions, conduct discovery is definitely a reasonable fee in this case.
Okay, I've got one last question.
Yes, Your Honor.
On this question about having the motion transfer hearing in a reasonable time, can we assume that all the young associates over at Brown Pruitt were let loose to try to find such cases, and this no writ case from Austin was it?
No, Your Honor, I was the one that researched that motion, and there is actually another case, I'm sorry I don't have the site for you, but where they said that 14 months was a lack of diligence that I found yesterday. I haven't researched that issue extensively. When I found that case, those are the said what I needed it to say, and those are the ones that I relied on and went with
all
that.
Right. So we don't have a Supreme Court case or
something? No, Your Honor, I don't have a Supreme Court
okay.
case.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, I want to say that there was no second motion to transfer. There was only one. The second motion was for entry of judgment, actually, on the motion to transfer.
I think his issue is with the hearing on it, that there wasn't diligence in having the hearing on the motion.
Well, that's correct, counsel.
That's your issue.
Yes.
Okay, not filing the motion, but having it heard.
The motion transfer was originally set for hearing about 90 days after it was filed. We appeared at the time of that hearing, and the other and the appellee's attorney did not appear. Mm-hmm. The only reason that we didn't have an order transferring venue at that point was that I thought I had sent notice to him for the hearing, but I had nothing in my file that would confirm that a fax was sent to him. So, in all fairness, I couldn't say that he received notice.
Was there a response or reply to your motion to transfer?
There was no response.
Okay.
There was no response ever filed that I know of to the actual motion to transfer. There was a response filed 4 days before the hearing on my motion for entry of judgment on the motion to transfer.
That would be the second hearing.
That would be the second one that was filed 14 months later. In the interim, we did have discussions about an agreed motion to transfer, and we ultimately decided we would not we would not agree to pay for the cost of that. So there was a follow-up by sending an order to the council for his approval. Then his reply to me that said that we never received notice, looking through the file indicating that I couldn't confirm that he had received notice, so I asked him to agree to sign the order as an agreed order. And then after that, when there was a finally no agreement on the motion to transfer, we then, there was a period of time that did pass, and then we filed a motion for entry of judgment. So I would argue that we were reasonably diligent in pursuing the motion to transfer, and we did file, that we did follow up after the initial motion and the initial hearing on the motion, and that we followed up in terms of trying to reach an agreement on the motion to transfer. When that didn't work, then maybe 2 or 3 months after that, we filed our motion for entry of judgment. So, and I think that's kind of lined out in the motion for entry of judgment. So I believe that given the follow-up after the hearing and discussions with counsel, you can't say that we ignored the motion to transfer and that we diligently pursued it. When he talks about the discovery and the surprise that it caused, he was talking in terms of the fact that the answer that was filed on behalf of the corporation and on behalf of the individual denied all of the claims and not just offsets. However, he does not address at all the issue with regard to John Anderson as the individual defendant, which ever since the motion to transfer was filed, he was on notice that Mr. Anderson was denying liability on the basis that he was an officer of the company and not individually liable. That is something that pervaded the whole case from the beginning of the initial pleading on file all the way through the trial. Okay.
I don't know about my fellow justices, but you just lost me. You lost me. What difference does that make as to what he was prepared to try with what he had and then with the addition of the answer?
Well, Your Honor, simply this is that he's arguing that simply the reason he was surprised was because we filed an answer that basically denied all of the invoices. He does not address at all the answer of Mr. Anderson, which basically says he's denying liability not because there were offsets. He was denying liability because he was not individually liable for the corporation's debt. That was in the original motion to transfer and has been a part of the case ever since the motion to transfer was filed.
I think what Justice McCoy is saying, the fact that he may not have been surprised on that one issue doesn't negate his surprise that he's asserted concerning the denial of every single charge. That's where I got lost. I mean, yeah. So he wasn't surprised on one issue. Well, where does that get you?
Well, I think that there's then a difference between the two defendants here. You have the corporation, who you could say had the defense of the offset, and the individual who is basically relying on the fact that he was not individually liable. Certainly, he should have been prepared to establish individual liability at the time of trial, which is more of a legal issue than a fact issue anyhow.
Your time has expired. Are there any other questions? Thank you. Uh-huh. Thank you, counsel, both for appearing here today. Your arguments have been very helpful to us, and your case is submitted. We will take a brief recess until 10:30 for a panel change, at which time we'll take up our 10:30 docket. And counsel on that case can feel free to move forward and set up.